loud and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening, and it's happening now. I'm John Kiriakou, and I'm joined in studio by co-host Brian Becker. In this hour, we take a look at the breaking news of the day. First, Lanny Davis, the attorney for President Trump's lawyer Michael Cohen, is backing off statements he made last week that Cohen has information to share with investigators, indicating that Trump knew in 2016 of Russian efforts to undermine the Hillary Clinton campaign. And attorneys for accused Russian spy Maria Butina say that federal allegations that Butina traded sex for information are nonsense, and the text messages back them up. Next, Iranian Defense Minister Amir Hatemi met today with Syrian President Bashar al-Assad and pledged Iranian help in the reconstruction of Syria, as well as enhanced defense cooperation. The United Nations estimates that the country will need $388 billion to rebuild from a seven-year-long civil war that has seen the deaths of more than 350,000 people. Then the North Korean government reacted angrily today after Secretary of State Mike Pompeo canceled his planned visit to that country. Pompeo cited a lack of progress in bilateral talks as the reason for the decision, but North Korea said that the U.S. was hatching a criminal plot against Pyongyang and that the U.S. was not serious about negotiations. And then, in a victory for labor unions, a federal judge on Saturday struck down key provisions of a series of executive orders that would have made it easier to fire federal workers and weaken their unions. The ruling is a major setback for President Trump's policy of trying to break unions, especially those that represent federal workers. And finally, today we continue our segment Education for Liberation with Bill Ayers, where Bill helps us look at the state of education across the country. What's happening in our schools, colleges, and universities, and what impact does it have on the world around us? That's all coming up next on Loud and Clear. Now we turn to the so-called Russiagate investigation. Lanny Davis, the attorney for President Trump's lawyer Michael Cohen, is backing off statements he made last week that Cohen has information to share with investigators, indicating that President Trump knew in 2016 of Russian efforts to undermine the Hillary Clinton campaign. It turns out that was a lie. And attorneys for accused Russian spy Maria Butina say that federal allegations that Butina traded sex for information are nonsense. We're joined from Minnesota by Colleen Rowley. She's a former FBI special agent who in 2002 was named Time Magazine Person of the Year, along with two other whistleblowers. Colleen, welcome back.
Yes, thanks for having me.
Colleen, an attorney lied in the media? Is that even possible?
You're talking about Lanny Davis, right?
Right. Lanny Davis, who we should say was one of Bill Clinton's attorneys. He was actually the lead attorney for Bill Clinton during the impeachment process.
Yeah, and now he's Michael Cohen's. Why did Michael Cohen possibly hire Lanny Davis? Anyway, Colleen, we're just being snarky here. Go ahead.
Well, you've fallen on a snarky person here because I've given three commencement speeches at prominent law schools where I mentioned the other name for lawyers. The title of my commencement speech was "Don't Be a Pettifogger." And a pettifogger, and very few people in the audience knew what a pettifogger is, but that is a shyster. It's a derogatory term for a lawyer. And unfortunately, we kind of see the seedier side of the whole attorney profession going on right now. They are just like our media, you know, they're selective in what they want to put out. Everyone thinks perception management it matters more than reality. I will say, let's give Lanny Davis some credit for finally realizing that this would catch up with him by trying to paint this picture. So at least you can give him that kind of credit. He was thinking ahead, like, well, when we finally do get into there and they find out that Cohen doesn't know much about Trump's meetings, et cetera, then I'll have egg on my face. So he was just kind of thinking ahead, probably. But it's a sad business right now.
Colleen, but, you know, when Lanny Davis went on MSNBC right after Michael Cohen pled guilty to these eight charges, and there was no, as far as I know, and correct me if I'm wrong, the agreement, the plea deal that Cohen made did not include a cooperation agreement with Mueller or the Mueller probe. But then Lanny Davis went on MSNBC and said, Michael Cohen knows about the information that will basically show that Donald Trump Sr. knew that Donald Trump Jr. was meeting with that Russian lawyer at Trump Tower in June 2016 when Trump Jr. was promised, quote, dirt on on Hillary Clinton from the Russians, and that this would prove that Donald Trump was, in fact, had foreknowledge of it, which Trump has denied. And then right after that, this GoFundMe thing starts up.
Right.
And Michael Cohen raises $150,000 because maybe people who hate Trump, and of course I'm an opponent of Trump, but people who hate Trump such that they'll do anything to bring down Trump, start giving money to Michael Cohen because he might be the linchpin providing the as of yet unsubstantiated evidence about collusion. Could it all have just been a Lanny Davis scam?
You know, I think you're connecting the dots here, because that money in the GoFundMe is ultimately not going to go stay with Cohen. Cohen apparently has serious financial woes and probably couldn't pay Lanny Davis to the extent to which he is accustomed without these kinds of, tens of thousands of dollars flowing in. So, yes, that's quite likely one of the motivations here. Lanny Davis wants to be paid. And the second motivation, I think I alluded to, which is managing the media. Instead of waiting for an actual trial where, you know, the attorneys get to put out their best facts and arguments, a lot of attorneys now are realizing that, you know, going to the media first. And, you know, what he's done is very similar to when a newspaper prints a wrong article, that when they print some kind of false allegation. And then, you know, 2 weeks later, they print the retraction in the back of the page that nobody sees. And, you know, Lanny Davis is an expert at this kind of thing.
Yeah, it's true. I sort of peripherally know Lanny Davis. He's a major figure here in Washington. And he charges $1,000 an hour. I know that to be a fact. $1,000 an hour. Let me tell you, that adds up right quickly, especially when you have an army of associates working along with him that are charging you $500, $575, whatever it is, an hour. Michael Cohen has earned literally tens of millions of dollars over the years. Apparently, he's spent a good amount of it, too. And he's going to have to pay a monumental fine. So the guy's going to be broke.
But are liberals who care?
That's what hurts me.
Are liberals actually now funding Michael Cohen's GoFundMe? Because Trump supporters won't be doing that. And
that's right. And we're living in bizarro world. Everything's upside down.
And what
now
about Peter Stroke?
Peter Stroke is another one. You know, Peter Stroke, just because Donald Trump at one point said Peter Stroke is a Democrat, and I have no idea if that's true, but Donald Trump said he's a Democrat. Democrats are jumping out of their chairs to donate money to Peter Stroke. You pointed out, Brian, that Peter Stroke's GoFundMe campaign has raised nearly $500,000.
Yeah, for the fired FBI official Peter Stroke, Colleen, the goal that he set for his GoFundMe, because he's such a victim of the system, was $500,000. But as of now, he's raised $460,423 for Peter Stroke.
Insane.
It's gross.
You know, for those of us who at one time, and I will have to say, I confess that I was one of them, I always had this notion that liberal mindset meant critical thinking. And unfortunately, in this Russiagate hysteria that's going on right now, it is a groupthink. It is simply pressing that old partisan loyalty emotional button on people. And you can see this throughout history. Manipulators have realized, you know, the best example, you go back to the Nazis saying, you just tell them, oh, it's hard to get them to go to war, but you just tell them that they're being attacked. You press fear, hate, greed, false pride, and blind loyalty. And partisanship is nothing but false pride and blind loyalty. Those are very dangerous emotions, really. They're vices. They're basically vulnerabilities and vices. And you can get groups of people basically turning into lynch mobs. It's really sad. And, you know, I have to say it's depressing to realize this kind of really vulnerability on the part of humans. But you're seeing it on the liberals right now, especially on the liberals. Before we leave this topic, I just wanted to mention that when McCarthy started this back in the 1950s, there was a Republican female senator, Margaret Chase Smith, who gave these wonderful speeches to her fellow senators, kind of like FDR. We only have fear, you know, fear is the only thing we have to fear. And stop with this hysteria and get your minds back. I mean, she was really kind of lecturing them, but unfortunately she failed, and the McCarthy hysteria had to run the full gamut with all of the destructiveness that it entailed. And unfortunately, we need another Margaret Chase Smith to do this in Congress right now, to basically tell people, come on, get your minds back. Stop with this fear in, you know, fear and blind loyalty stuff that's really causing us to go off the edge.
Yeah, I hear Colleen so well. You know, liberal used to mean something different, mm-hmm. I think, than what it does. And in fact, all these definitions and labels are no longer actually meaning anything. You know, as a teenager, because I grew up in the early 60s, my parents were part of the civil rights movement. We thought of ourselves as liberals. My brother, when I was 15, asked me if I considered myself a liberal, and I said yes, and I was proud to be a liberal, because that meant you're for civil rights.
Right.
Or you're for peace, or you're against the war in Vietnam. But he gave me the Phil Oakes song called Love Me, Love Me, Love Me, I'm a Liberal. And I wanna read one of the choruses to you, Colleen and John. Once I was young and impulsive, I wore every conceivable pin, even went to the socialist meetings, learned all the old union hymns. But I've grown older and wiser, and that's why I'm turning you in. So love me, love me, love me. I'm a liberal. Anyway, I think Phil Oakes was onto something.
Yeah, I think so. And, you know, we'll just have to see. It will wear out. I mean, I think history tells us this kind of groupthink hysteria will eventually run its course, and people will slowly get their minds back. But right now, it's very depressing to see that the facts, and again, this really helps people who claim that facts don't matter, that it's all about manipulating the media. And then, of course, with our social media and alternative media being repressed, and some of my colleagues have been censored on Facebook and everything else. Again, this goes right to what Margaret Chase Smith lectured at the early part of the McCarthy period. You know, this is what we're entering into, and it's absolutely ridiculous. It's hurting the country. I'll make a comment about the Butina. Because I actually have my experience in the FBI, a lot of it, especially when I worked in New York City on the mob trials that went to court, and Chertoff and all those other prosecutors prosecuted these mobsters. My job actually for a couple of years was listening to, interpreting, and transcribing the conversations that were later played at trial. And so I can sympathize with the difficulty of interpreting. And so in this case where they apparently misinterpreted Butina to say she, you know, was trading sex and is a seductress, whatever, and it's this perfectly innocent conversation with a friend, if you don't have a lot of context to go on and you have the backdrop of hysteria where, you know, your bosses want you to find this, I can see how this misinterpretation would happen. And in fact, it happened all the time, even on far less important cases and with almost far less hysteria than now exists in the Russiagate case.
Yeah, those are important words. They are demonizing her, too. And that's the point her lawyer is making, whether it was by mistake, as Colleen says, you can easily make a mistake, or whatever it is, it becomes useful sort of fodder in this presentation, and she's still in solitary confinement.
Yeah, which makes no sense whatsoever. We're going to have to leave it there. We were joined from Minnesota by Colleen Rowley. Colleen's a former FBI special agent who in 2002 was named Time Magazine's Person of the Year, along with two other whistleblowers. Stay tuned to Loud and Clear. We'll take a short break and come right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
And clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
Iranian Defense Minister Amir Hatami met today with Syrian President Bashar al-Assad and pledged Iranian help in the reconstruction of Syria, as well as enhanced defense cooperation. The United Nations estimates that the country will need $388 billion to rebuild from a seven-year-long civil war that has seen the deaths of more than 350,000 people. We're joined from London by Masoud Shajara. He's the founder of the Islamic Human Rights Commission. Masoud, welcome back.
Pleasure to be with you.
Masoud, explain to us the the importance of this visit. Certainly the Iranians don't have the kind of money necessary to even begin to rebuild Syria. Was this visit really more about defense cooperation than reconstruction?
Well, I think it's actually both. It's saying that there is a commitment, as much as there was a commitment in sort of helping Syria to save itself against the aggression and the terrorism. And there is really commitment to help it to rebuild itself in a sort of better time. I think the fact is that, yes, indeed, Iran doesn't have the sort of money that United States or Europe or Saudi Arabia or the Gulf states have. But it's shown it has got the commitment. And that's what is really important here, the commitments and the know-how and the willingness to help and support, to bring some sort of tranquility and peace to that region. When you look at the Middle East, I think you see two types of intervention. There is one type of intervention that the West, under the leadership of the United States, has unleashed, which you see in Iraq, in Libya, in Yemen, in Syria, and you know, even Afghanistan, which really brings total chaos and disarray, destroys all infrastructure, every, you know, it affects and sort of diminishes peace and tranquility and affects every single citizen of those nations. And then there are those who actually want to bring some sort of tranquility back and stability back to the region. And I think the history shows that as much as United States and its allies have been committed to creating chaos, indeed others have actually been trying to bring some sort of a stability.
Masoud, it's been obvious that the U.S. government is putting pressure on Russia, sanctioning Russia, et cetera. It's also been engaged in diplomatic explorations with Russia to see whether or not Russia would join with the United States in demanding that Iran remove itself from Syria. And it seemed to me that the Russian position has been formally, yes, Iran and all foreign forces should leave Syria. And of course, American forces are there not at the invitation of the Syrian government and thus are there illegally. But they, the Russians, don't have any real influence over Iran. Iran is an independent, sovereign player, and Iran isn't going to leave. And I want you to explore that a little bit. And also, our audience may not know this history, that even during the Iran-Iraq war, where almost all of the Arab countries lined up behind Iraq, Syria, and I believe it may have been Syria alone amongst the Arab countries, stood with Iran during that conflict. So it's a strategic, long-term relationship. It's not a conjunctural relationship. Go ahead.
Absolutely. I think the fact is that there is a historical sort of relationship. And that historical relationship has been sort of not just on the basis of the politics of the day, but it's been sort of a relationship that dictated that we will not allow certain powers to gang up against one or another of these nations, both Syria and Iran. And to some extent, Syria stood up by that principle at a very difficult time that Iran was facing. And indeed, Iran sort of did exactly the same thing and stood up by Syria, although it was really sort of very difficult and very detrimental to its position internationally. But locally, it was absolutely necessity to fight Daesh. Nobody else was willing to put troops on the ground. And you couldn't fight Daesh and sort of defeat Daesh by just going around sort of bragging about it, or indeed just using air force and air power against it. And this is a reality. And so indeed, if Iran and Hezbollah wasn't involved in Syria and Iraq, we would have had Daesh not only establishing themselves in those areas, but also expand elsewhere into Lebanon, into sort of Iran, and indeed cause havoc, not just in indeed in the Middle East, but we saw how Daesh has actually effectively sort of destroyed peace and tranquility and the stability and the security in Europe and indeed even in the United States. So really, this was an essential thing to do. But also, I think, you know, the fact of the matter is that Iran, Russia, and Hezbollah and Syria are the victors. They are victorious in Syria and in Iraq. And indeed, you know, I think, you know, if we check back, usually those who are victor, they dictate what should happen in that region. And indeed, the United States, Israel, and sort of European allies are not the victors. They're actually, they lost that incident in Syria and in Iraq, and they're not being seen as part of the solution. So they cannot dictate what should happen, first of all. Secondly, I think it's very important that Iran's involvement in Syria happened only because of the mingling and the way that United States and indeed its allies with Saudi Arabia and other Gulf states started supporting the terrorist groups and you know what they called it sort of opposition to Assad, which in reality was sort of a groups of known terrorist organization and extremists and takfiris and, you know, including Daesh. And so therefore, really Iran's involvement in it, what Iran did not create the problem. Indeed, it was the United States and the policy of regime change in Syria who created the havoc in that area and actually brought those elements in, which Iran had to, and Russia had to respond by trying to go in and put an end to it. This is the similar situation that we are having in Libya. But in Libya, Russia, Iran, and Hezbollah are not getting involved to clean up the act of the United States and its allies creating that havoc. So we are seeing a continuation of that havoc. We are seeing the continuation of sort of insecurity and chaos in Libya. And thank God for this involvement, we are seeing the end of that in Syria and in Iraq. And I think international community and ordinary people in United States, Europe, and everywhere else, they need to actually open up their eyes and see that this involvement was only became necessary because of the havoc that was caused out of that conflict, which was fueled and financed by these elements, including United States, Saudi Arabia, and others. And, you know, for United States to now demand that these sort of cooperation between Iran and Syria, which has been cemented yet again because of this support, should be sort of dismantled is foolish and it's not going to happen.
We're speaking with Masoud Shajara. Masoud is the founder of the Islamic Human Rights Commission. He joins us from London. Masoud, I want to ask you about the Strait of Hormuz. It's been in the news again lately, and it seems to me as though we may have a replay of the 1980s, where Ronald Reagan, when he was president, ordered escorts to ferry oil tankers in and out of the Gulf through the Strait of Hormuz. The Iranian government has said that it would consider closing the strait. Of course, something like a third of the West's oil comes through the strait. What do you think is going to happen there? What are we looking at in terms of a potential conflict again?
Yeah, and before you answer, Masoud, the General Alireza Tangsiri, Iranian Revolutionary Guard, said Iran has full control of both the Persian Gulf itself and the Strait of Hormuz. 1 minute left.
They obviously have got the full control. I mean, anyone who has gone to the region or anyone who has assessed the military and the strategy of the area knows that it's not going to take a lot to actually close that. And indeed, it will give Iran has got its right to sort of demand investigating ships that actually go through that region. But the point is this, at the end of the day, the fact of the matter is that if for whatever reason Iran is denied its legitimate right of being involved in selling and doing business with the international community through bullying of mafioso style by Trump and his administration, then it's going to leave Iran very little option but to respond, you know, tit for tat. I hope that we don't see that. And I think to a large extent, the European community and the rest of the world don't want to see that. And that's why they want to find a resolution. But nevertheless, that is actually has to be the ultimate thing on the card. If everything is on the table, that will be part of the option of Iran, which has to be left on the table.
Masoud, we're going to have to leave it there. That was the voice of Masoud Shajara. He's the founder of the Islamic Human Rights Commission. He joined us from London. Stay tuned to Loud and Clear. We'll be right back after a short break.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
The North Korean government reacted angrily today after Secretary of State Mike Pompeo canceled his planned visit to that country. Pompeo cited a lack of progress in bilateral talks as the reason for the decision. But North Korea said that the U.S. was hatching a criminal plot against Pyongyang and that the U.S. was not serious about negotiations. We're joined from Santa Cruz, California, by Dr. Christine Hong, Associate Professor of Critical Race and Ethnic Issues at UC Santa Cruz and a member of the Korea Policy Institute. Christine, welcome back.
Thank you.
Christine, is this just posturing by the two sides, or is this a real problem that we are suddenly seeing in our very new bilateral relationship?
Well, we weren't exactly proceeding from secure footing prior to this. So, I mean, you know, these kinds of, you know, highs and lows, I would imagine will be part of the process. But I really hope that this isn't going to be the start of a series of these kinds of sort of stalled moments. You know, I mean, it's really unfortunate for this to happen at this point. It's interesting that it's not just that North Korea is stating that the United States was conducting secret war exercises. It's also the case that just the kind of narrative that's prevailing right now in the media is that North Korea is not a reliable sort of partner to negotiate with, and that Donald Trump was really foolish to even entertain the possibility of negotiations of any kind. And what this centrally does not acknowledge is the fact that almost all of the give and take, the give, has come from North Korea. All that the United States has done in return, and this is keeping in mind that North Korea has stated from the very outset that it's willing to do measure for measure. It's willing to do a step-by-step process in terms of negotiations, which means that for everything that it does, it expects a good faith gesture, some sort of action, commensurate action on the part of the United States. What has North Korea done so far? North Korea has not only capped its nuclear testing for something like 200 days. It's also, it's basically suspended that, and that's huge. It's dismantled nuclear testing sites. The other thing that it's done is it released three Korean Americans who were in prison in North Korea for, committing sort of acts against the state. And then, you know, recently it released the remains for repatriation of 55 American servicemen who were killed during the hot fighting period of the Korean War. What the United States has done is suspend one war exercise. And so, like, if you're looking at the kind of, you know, if you're looking at the balance sheet, it's actually not the case that North Korea is not keeping up its end of the bargain. It's really the United States.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. There's been one, as Christine Hong has said, one act after another, basically unilateral on the part of the DPRK, for which there has not been reciprocation. I have another theory, Christine, and I, even if I'm right, I still hope it won't succeed. But it seems to me that behind the scenes, too, John Bolton and the other people who are clearly and historically 100% opposed to any sort of normalization of relations with the DPRK are also trying to subvert by relying on and working with behind the scenes conservative forces inside South Korea, trying to subvert or topple, carry out regime change actually in South Korea, because Moon Jae-in has been such an indispensable force along with Kim Jong-un in terms of creating the momentum for this process. You can sort of see in the background storm clouds gathering. And I can't imagine, given how popular Moon Jae-in's initiatives were, that this would be coming organically necessarily from South Korea, more likely from people in Washington. And I would put Bolton right at the top of that potential list. Anyway, what about that?
Yeah, you know, I couldn't agree more. You know, it's a sad fact that Bolton has actually met with conservative minority party in South Korea, you know, a party that is vehemently anti any sort of engagement with North Korea. And this is a profoundly minority view, even if Moon Jae-in's overall sort of popularity ratings have somewhat tanked in recent weeks. The fact of the matter is that his pro-engagement with North Korea policy was and still is a kind of majority policy. He was deputized by the South Korean people to do that. So what you see right now is the United States basically acting against the democratic interests of the Korean people, both North and South. And, you know, you see the United States willing to try to exert whatever kind of influence it has to, you know, basically upend any sort of possibility of peace. It's not the first time that we've seen this. You know, during the George W. Bush era, this was also a time of historic rapprochement between the two Koreas. And who did George W. Bush aligned himself with in South Korea? Well, he aligned himself with basically diehard, hawkish North Korean sort of human rights activists, these, you know, figures, some of whom were defectors and really had a kind of war agenda with regard to North Korea. And against the desires of the overwhelming majority of the Korean people, North and South, for peace and reconciliation, he went against the sunshine policy of the then liberal presidents who were in South Korea and embraced a sort of defector-based human rights war interventionist policy that you could call an eclipse policy.
Yes, indeed. Christine Hong is our guest. Christine is an associate professor of critical race and ethnic studies at UC Santa Cruz. She's also a member of the Korea Policy Institute. It was Donald Trump who took ownership over the cancellation of Pompeo's trip. He said, "I suggested that he not go because there wasn't enough progress." And, you know, of course, with Trump and his own personal brand of diplomacy, one might not really know what this means. He also said in some of his utterances things about Kim Jong-un that were not completely hostile. So seeming like maybe the door was still open. Perhaps it is. We hope it is. But he also attributed China and the Chinese leadership or their failure to, quote, do enough, close quote, as part of the problem. Do you see Trump sort of focusing more on China now, because obviously that's a big part of Trump's foreign policy focus, and then using North Korea as a wedge there?
You know, Trump's take on China has been perplexing to me from day one. And so, you know, from the very beginning, he suggested that it was still a kind of version of that old, very strange approach of trying to outsource U.S. North Korea policy to China when the geostrategic interests of both nations are not one and the same. But I think that, like, right now, what we're looking at is the fact, a couple of things. One, the way that Trump is, I think that when Trump was speaking the prospect of peace with North Korea, you could see a kind of rigid spine response on the part of all of those who stand up and salute the military-industrial complex. So you basically had the, you know, bipartisan war party emerge in force, you know, and, you know, against the prospect of Trump even being able to draw down U.S. forces abroad, you know, he has this very sort of weird notion that U.S. military occupation abroad is a form of charity to those nations that are so occupied. But be that as it may, like his desire to draw things down has been resisted on the level of Congress. And, you know, so you have basically, he's not getting any political capital from pushing a kind of engagement policy with North Korea in this particular juncture. With regard to China and Russia, I think it's very interesting that they've, you know, just been talking sense. So China has really moved away from a kind of policy of, you know, walking more or less in lockstep with U.S. sanctions policy. And they've stated, rightly so, that right at this particular moment, when North Korea has made a number of good faith concessions for the prospect of engagement with the United States, that the United States actually needs to scale back some of its sanctions. Russia has said the same. And so basically, you're just seeing a kind of division on the level of policy in which the U.S. perspective and China's perspective with regard to North Korea in this moment when North Korea is making great strides to try to outreach to the United States, you just see a cleavage in policy.
I hope, John, that people read Dr. Christine Hong's work and those of others at the Korea Policy Institute. Very, very important to get real information.
Real information, real unbiased information. Well, that was the voice of Dr. Christine Hong. She's an associate professor of critical race and ethnic studies at UC Santa Cruz, and she's a member of the Korea Policy Institute. Stay tuned to Loud and Clear. We'll be right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
And clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou in studio with my co-host Brian Becker. In a victory for labor unions, a federal judge on Saturday struck down key provisions of a series of executive orders that would have made it easier to fire federal workers and weaken their unions. The ruling is a major setback for President Trump's policy of trying to break unions, especially those that represent federal workers. We're joined from Los Angeles by Jeff Bigelow. He's an organizer with AFSCME, the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees. And we're joined in studio by Sputnik News analyst and producer Walter Smolarek. Welcome to both of you.
Happy to be here.
Thank you.
So, Jeff, let's start with you. This has got to be a welcome development for unions. They've taken it on the chin the last several years, and this really is a setback for the Trump administration. Tell us why it's so important.
Well, it's so important because the Trump administration has been targeting labor with direct frontal attacks and had attempted in May to by way of executive order to force through very anti-labor actions, essentially gutting much of the collective bargaining rights that that federal employees had, also the rights to representation, also the rights people have when they're about when they're going to be disciplined. And so all of the public sector unions with members in the public in the federal sector band together to challenge this legally. And this decision that came out on the 25th was a major blow to Trump's plans. And in fact, he was pushed back on just about every front. The use of official time by unions to be able to represent their members is now reestablished, even though the Trump administration had tried to stop that. They were pushed back in terms of the ability to use facilities and on federal property. They were pushed back in terms of the time to take to prepare a defense for somebody in terms of grievances and in many other ways. So it was a victory.
And public employees represent, is it accurate to say that public employees represent the bulk of union membership in the country? I know that proportionally a much, much higher percentage of public sector workers, you know, workers for different levels of government and public enterprises, proportionally they're much more likely to be unionized than those in the private sector. But tell us about sort of the big picture significance for this in terms of the labor movement and where union workers are.
Yes, as you mentioned, the most highly organized sector of labor is in the public sector, at the federal level, at the state and county level, and the city level. And so it's about 35% as compared to maybe 6 or 7% in the private sector. So the targeting of the public sector through the Janus decision in the Supreme Court, the targeting of the public sector in terms of many different initiatives to destroy pensions, the targeting of the public sector in so many ways, has been designed to try to eliminate the last strong part of the labor movement, to give them free rein to do whatever they want. And so that's the context within which this is happening. And so this, you know, every event where we can stop that, resist that, delay that, represents a victory for labor.
The Obama administration, too, I mean, when we talk about the attacks on federal employees, the Obama administration, if I'm not mistaken, imposed a wage freeze for a number of years, right? I mean, there is sort of like this long, like, war of attrition against federal workers.
And that went back to the Bush administration, too,
Oh, the Bush administration, too, yeah. Yeah, so it's sort of this bipartisan attack, and the Trump administration, it seems to me, is sort of kicking that into overdrive, but not necessarily coming up with a novel position.
That's correct. This is not a qualitatively new development. Every president has, particularly since the laws were passed to have, for example, comparable pay with the private sector, every single president has said that that they filed the necessary paperwork to get an exception to that. So whether it's Obama or Trump, they both did the same thing on that. So now there's a huge gap between the pay that's given to the federal public sector workers versus private sector workers doing approximately the same thing. And not just that. I mean, Obama, when he got in 2008, everybody thought that he was going to be supporting EFCA, the Employee Free Choice Act, that he was going to put some muscle behind that. He was going to push it to get it passed. And, of course, he never did. He said when he was campaigning that he was going to be the first president to walk a picket line when he was on the picket line at the Congress Hotel in Chicago. Of course, that never happened. So there are many, many, many things that he did. He didn't even mention the word union for the first couple of years of his administration. So many things that he did that were anti-labor. And Trump, as you said, has sort of kicked that into much higher gear. Actually, you know, putting that also into historical perspective, the court in this case relied upon a 1978 law, a civil service law signed into law by Jimmy Carter. And Jimmy Carter was known at the time by many people and called William Winspinger, was the head of the machinist union at that time. He called him the greatest Republican president of our time. And the reason he did that is because he had a long history of undermining the labor movement and not doing anything like Obama, not doing anything to put muscle behind the things that he claimed that he would have supported when he was running for office. So when there was a bill that was up that was very important to labor about the right to picket construction sites, and that was defeated. There was a bill in 1978 to kill a strike replacement, and that was defeated. He essentially supported the gutting of the Humphrey Hawkins full employment bill. And, of course, Carter set up the PATCO situation, which Reagan executed. So all of these Democratic presidents have an anti-labor record. And so even the reform that was foisted upon them in 1978 that's now used in this 40 years later, is now used in this court decision, shows a trend.
Let me ask you also about Congress. Where does Congress stand in all this? Are you seeing any light at the end of the tunnel in terms of Congress helping American workers to recapture some of the strength and authority that they once had?
No, I haven't seen any real developments in that realm. There were a few Republican Congress people who after Trump issued these executive orders, who were under particular pressure in their own districts, did issue some letters and some statements calling for him to reverse himself. But, you know, that's minor stuff. There has been no significant move within Congress to reverse this. We essentially have to depend on ourselves. We have to build a movement that creates the environment where this has to be done, where these things have to be reversed.
Yeah, in just the last minute and a half that we have left, I wanted to ask you about that because, of course, the labor movement has many different tactics that it can use to fight. It can, you know, of course, go on strike. It can call for boycotts of anti-worker employers, you know, particularly anti-worker employers. And it can also struggle in the courts, which is what happened with this victory that we're talking about, the overturning of the Trump administration's executive orders targeting federal workers. You mentioned the Janus case a little bit earlier, this devastating, not fatal, but, you know, very serious blow dealt to the labor movement by the Supreme Court not too long ago. But here you have an example of the struggle in the courts being successful. Just comment on that a little bit. I mean, what is the moment call for?
Well, the head of the Office of Personnel Management, the personnel office essentially of the federal government, in April, prior to the executive order, said that their strategy would be to push on every front through executive orders, through laws, and through other means to at the bargaining table, et cetera, to push back labor, to tear apart our rights, et cetera, to drive down the level of rights and respect that people have won on the job. And by the same token, we have to use every means at our disposal, whether or not that's in the courts or in the streets. We have to use all of our means. And of course, the primary lever for achieving real change, real social change, as you know, is developing a movement that unites the community, unites labor to push for socially progressive things. And, you know, I talked about this law, 40 years ago. There is an event that's 75 years ago that sort of highlights this. 75 years ago, Marie Richardson, who at the age of 23 became the first African-American woman to lead a national union. It was the United Federal Workers Union. And she was a very progressive person and very strong person. And she was organizing federal employees, cafeteria workers, private sector contracts, et cetera. She was a leader in the National Negro Congress. She went on trial because she refused to take this loyalty oath. She got a sentence of 28 months to 7 years in jail. But she was a determined leader, despite whatever obstacles were in front of her, like Trump, like all the reactionary things that go on, to drive to build a bigger, stronger movement. And we need more people like that today.
We do indeed. We're going to have to leave it there, though. We were joined from Los Angeles by Jeff Bigelow. Jeff is an organizer with AFSCME, the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees. You're listening to Loud and Clear. Stay tuned. We'll be right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
Today we continue our segment, Education for Liberation, with Bill Ayers, where Bill helps us look at the state of education across the country. What's happening in our schools, colleges, and universities, and what impact does it have on the world around us? Bill's back, and he joins us from Chicago. He's an activist, educator, and the author of the book Demand the Impossible, A Radical Manifesto. You can check out his work at www.billayers.org. Bill, welcome back.
Thanks for having me. It's good to hear your voices again.
Same here, Bill. And before we started this segment, we were talking amongst ourselves about how you've been gone for a while, 6 or 8 weeks, and you recommended a lot of people, education professors from across the country, to fill in for this for you on this segment, and every one of them was absolutely outstanding in a different way, absolutely incredible. So let's talk about, just recap some of the issues that we discussed with them. Things like the school-to-prison pipeline, which actually was very important to me personally, how to work with students dealing with trauma, affirmative action, minorities in education. To you, what are some of the issues besides these that are the most critical in education across the country today?
Well, I think the biggest fight we're having today is the question of what is education for in a aspirationally free society. I mean, the idea that somehow this public treasure, public education, has been under sustained attack for three decades, and we've reached the point where people are at their wits' end, and we're seeing wildcat strikes all over the country in the spring. I expect that will come again. But, you know, I think it's also noteworthy, and I think some of the folks you had on are, you know, good friends and tremendous comrades. But they really are at the heart of some of these issues. You mentioned the prison school pipeline. I mean, one of the things, when you have an economy like ours, when you have capitalism in its end days, you create a lot of disposable people. And those disposable people are geared to the prison. So I think that we have to look at schools and the struggles around schools as both window and mirror into the larger social struggles that we're involved in: racism and white supremacy, economic inequality, oppression and exploitation, and the discarding of mass numbers of people who are no longer useful to the capitalist juggernaut. And so we see the rise of prisons, we see the rise of unemployment, we see the rise of stagnation in wages, and so on. And I think we're in a very powerfully a potential time of change, but also a very grim time for lots and lots of people on the ground.
And this is really a long-term issue, too. We've had good secretaries of education. We've had bad secretaries of education. The fact of the matter is, Congress doesn't seem to really care about this issue anymore. They're certainly not appropriating money for it. And then when you have secretaries of education who made their bones by cutting programs when they were, let's say, secretaries of education in their own state or in charge of the education system in large American cities, they're used to cutting programs rather than expanding or improving or coming up with some new idea to stop people from entering this school to prison pipeline, let's say.
Yeah, I mean, I think Congress has turned a blind eye on the question of public education, for sure. But so have many states. Oklahoma is just one extreme example. Arizona's another. West Virginia's another. But I'll just challenge you in a tiny little way. I can't name a good Secretary of Education.
I stand corrected.
I know you're being generous, but you go back to the beginning and you've got William Bennett, Rod Page, you know, Margaret Spellings. These are terrible, terrible administrators with a terrible vision of education. What we've witnessed in the last 30 years. So the schools are quite naturally a site of contention because the schools are where we as a people decide what our future ought to be. And there's no question that public education will always be a contested and contended space. But we remember, and people should always remember, the fight. Well, you can go to South Africa or Poland or China, but the fight in the south of the United States for integration was a fight for justice against white supremacy. And the result of that struggle to integrate the schools was the creation of private academies and white flight all over the South. Now we're seeing that today in the charter school movement. So under the name of choice, which was incidentally the same name that was used when people were fighting against racial integration, same logic also. We don't want to be thrust into a cauldron of the, quote, public. We want our ability to choose, and our ability to choose includes the right to choose to be free of being around black people. And that's what white folks are doing. And these charter schools in California, for example, where we have more charter schools than anywhere in the country, they're the most segregated schools also.
Yeah, absolutely right. Under the banner of choice, you have an attempt to resegregate schools or to, you know, have white kids not have to go to school with black kids or Latino kids. And of course, these are their parents making these kind of decisions in the name of choice, taking women's rights away, women's right to control their own bodies. I mean, it's always about choice. It's kind of this sort of trick, this propaganda or agitation trick, where by elevating the individual choice, it seems to put a premium on individuality. But when you look at the school system as a whole and the way these different systems work, it's actually ripping down individuality. It's if there's anything, if there's, you know, Albert Einstein said the biggest problem with capitalism was its war against the individual, which was, I think, kind of seemingly contradictory, because capitalism always speaks in the name of individualism, individual choice, individual liberty.
Yeah, exactly. Well, you're pointing out another thing, which I think is critical, which is language itself is a site of contention, a site of struggle. So the question of choice or the question of liberty, one of the things I often think when the capitalists or the 1% use our language against us, I always think, well, that's a nod in our direction because we've won that argument rhetorically, and they've taken the content and twisted it. A great example is the word freedom. When you think of the freedom struggles of the 60s, 70s, 80s, you think of freedom now, you think of the civil rights movement, you think of the women's movement. the gay liberation movement, or you think of the anti-imperialist struggles worldwide. But if you say to somebody, what does freedom mean today? Very often people will go to this question of individual freedom, not collective freedom, not freedom for the group, not freedom for the class, but this idea that it's kind of my ability to choose. And so you have this sweeping our culture that you have the gig economy. I mean, it's all about freedom. Go to Silicon Valley. That's all they can talk about is freedom. Or look at the Freedom Caucus. And I'm always reminded in that discussion that freedom was not only the battle cry of the abolitionists during the days of slavery, it was the battle cry of the Confederacy. Freedom to own other human beings, the only freedom they cared about. And so I think it's important that we probe the language and note that when people say choice, they're not saying choice in a way that's sweet and lovely and we ought to be singing little ditties on a hillside. It's actually choice to avoid the reality of the world we live in and ought to live in.
Bill Ayers is our guest. We have 2.5 minutes to go in this segment, Bill. I want to talk about this more next week, especially if you had a little bit more time to prepare for it. But, you know, kids are going back to school here in Washington. The schools started this week. A lot of expectations. Of course, it's the beginning. It's a new day, a new year. You know, it's all that stuff that happens at the beginning of the school year. And yet, after a little while, school starts to feel humdrum. It seems boring. It's too much homework. If you had an opportunity to craft the schools, the public schools, what are the things that we should be emphasizing? We only have 2 minutes now, but maybe next time we can talk more about that in a more fleshed out way. What are the key elements that public schools, all of them, need to be embracing?
Well, there are actually certain principles that a free society should insist on in its public schools. And one is starting with the idea that every human being is of incalculable value. And that means that we don't spend our time calculating that this kid is slightly above this kid in this standardized test. And we stop obsessing about that. And we begin to say, we want a school that is wide enough, broad enough, and deep enough that every child who comes in the door can find something familiar, something close in, and something from the neighborhood, the family, and also something to challenge them. And that's true of every child. And the idea that we've gotten stuck on with high-stakes standardized testing, that there's a single metric that can tell you who an educated person is, has been a tragedy for education in this country, but a real catastrophe for people from traditionally oppressed groups, the descendants of enslaved workers, the children of immigrants from poor nations, and so on. These kids have gotten screwed in this kind of, again, fake idea that we'll know what quality is if we have a high-stakes standardized test and line all the kids up against each other. So I start with that notion. Every kid deserves a right to a fully staffed, fully resourced public education within reach of their home, not something they have to jump through hoops to get to, but something right on the corner or within walking distance. That's the goal. That's the aspiration. That's what we ought to be fighting for.
We have to wrap it up there, but before we close out, I want to say that there was just some breaking news indicating that the official in the Department of Education who is in charge of the National Student Loan Program just announced his resignation, saying that the program is simply unworkable and does not help students. But we will leave it there. That was the voice of Bill Ayers. Bill joined us from Chicago. He's an activist, educator, and the author of the book Demand the Impossible, A Radical Manifesto. You can check out his work at www.billayers.org. You've been listening to Loud and Clear. We're completely out of time. Be sure to go to our Facebook page, Loud and Clear with Brian Becker, for daily updates. If you enjoy the show and want your friends to hear it, let us know by liking the page on Facebook. And you can follow us now on Twitter at Loud Clear Radio. You can also hear us every day, Monday through Friday, from 4 to 6 p.m. on 105.5 FM and 1390 AM in the Washington, D.C. area. You can also hear us at SputnikNews.com and as a podcast at iTunes and at iHeartRadio. Remember, telling the truth is important, but to make a difference, it has to be loud and clear. We'll see you next time.
Loud and Clear. We'll be right back.